said that principles are all very well, but it is the application of principles which is all important. It was obviously not Boyle's law which drove the Queen Mary across the Atlantic in the age of steam, but rather the application of Boyle's law through the mechanism of burning coal to create steam, etc., which drove the Queen Mary. It quite often happens that people understand how to apply a principle without ever knowing of the existence or the nature of that principle. For instance, hundreds of years before Captain Cook's voyages proved a scurvy cure existed, a French explorer, Jacques Cartier, was frozen into the St. Lawrence River. And in the course of that long winter, all the crew had scurvy, and none of them ever expected to see their beloved France again. Fortunately, a native Indian chanced upon them and indicated that they ought to be eating the powdered bark of certain trees and the needles of the white pine. Of course, desperate men are given to desperate measures, though eating pine needles may not be everyone's choice of fare. Nevertheless, they did as the Indian suggested, recovered from the scurvy, and returned to France with the tremendous news that a cure for scurvy had been discovered. The medical authorities of Europe, when they heard that this cure had come from an ignorant savage on the other side of the world, dismissed it as quite impossible. What, after all, could an ignorant, uneducated savage know, when the best medical minds in Europe had been perplexed by the question of scurvy for generations? It took several centuries before finally Cook and other navigators, not understanding even then that vitamin C existed or how exactly it was important to the body, instituted procedures and proved them and established support for them, thus removing scurvy as one of the great banes of mankind. In the period between the cure being discovered and the cure being accepted, 1 million English seamen died of scurvy. A principle that is useful or essential will not cure scurvy or serve any other objective, but the application of it clearly can, and the correct application of it certainly will. Of course, principles are not created by men. They are merely discovered. In the same way that truth transcends human thinking, so too do principles, if they are true. Human beings have a great propensity for self-delusion, especially if it is convenient or flattering. An example might be given in the story of the king who, thinking he was well-dressed, actually had no clothes on. All the people carried on the deception because the social price for stating the truth was considered too high. There are, however, some subjective things that are so because you think they are so. If you become completely convinced that you will soon be sick, then no doubt you will be sick. If, similarly, you are convinced that you are a raving lunatic, you are likely to act as one, and therefore everybody else is likely to concur in your judgment. However, principles partake of something more than subjective opinion or contention. They have to do with absolutes, and there are absolutes, and if we are wise, we will attempt to discover these and obey them. Principles have been enunciated in order to enable more effective action to be taken. Nothing happens in any sphere without the application of principles. And principles, if they are correct, help us to achieve objectives. However, the French medical authorities who rejected the scurvy cure were no doubt men of principle too. However, incorrect principles can literally kill millions. In this section, we are not so much discussing the principles and the abstractions and the concepts, but rather their application. This session is about doing things, if you like, belling the cat, which comes after the selection of a desirable objective. Although people of action quite often display disinterest, and sometimes even contempt, for considerations of a philosophical type, it is our concept of reality, our philosophy, from which the bias of all our actions takes form. A person cannot act in general. All actions are specific, and therefore they involve an act of choice. Each choice is utterly dependent upon our concept of what is real, of what is true, or, if you like, our philosophy. If this philosophy is deficient, inadequate, or incorrect, then our actions will disappoint us to the extent that this is so. The first essentials of effective action are knowledge, will, and sanctions. Where there is a deficiency of any of these, nothing can happen. Knowledge, will, and sanctions. Intellectual resources must be expanded if the range of options for action are to be understood and efficiently exploited. We must, however, guard against the tendency to dither between the desirability of one option as opposed to the other. Bruce Small, former mayor of the Gold Coast in Australia, observed that in his particular age bracket, there were 5 self-made millionaires in his home state of Victoria. He noted that the only thing they had in common was that none of them could either read or write at the end of their formal education. They were first and foremost men of action. All had developed a consuming will to succeed prior to taking any particular interest in acquiring knowledge, and the ability to read and write had been added later. One's spiritual resources, or will, are every bit as important as knowledge, but neither, of course, are dispensable in expanding freedoms. Sanctions are also indispensable. To return to the story of the mice who met and decided upon the desirability of belling the cat. The mice who wanted to bell the cat exhibited a considerable will to achieve that objective. The difficulty arose that while they knew what needed to be done and how to do it, they lacked the sanctions to do it. The cat had all the sanctions, and martyrdom seemed fruitless on the part of any of their mice. Sanctions, it seems to me, fall into 3 categories. The first sanction is compulsion. Could the cat be compelled through a cat trap or to suffer the bell to be fixed to him? The second sanction is inducement. The cat might have been enticed to allow the bell to be affixed for a payment, such as information about the whereabouts of rats and tactical and strategic information about how to capture them. Then there is the sanction of the word. If the mice were particularly adept with words, and perhaps had a theoretician or two among them, they may succeed in rearranging the cat's philosophy or concept of reality, that he would perceive some benefit in having his presence heralded. Perhaps if he was a particularly vain cat, he might be induced with thoughts of the fear and trembling that would overcome all mice at so loudly heralded an approach. These 3 sanctions might be called compulsion, inducement, and befuddlement, or if you like, the gun, the dollar, and the word. If there is any other category of sanction, it remains unknown to me. The best answer I have ever heard as to who shall bell the cat was given by the English historian Thomas Henry Buckle in 1867. He said, "No great political improvements, no great reform, either legislative or executive, has ever been originated in any country by its rulers. The first great suggestions of such steps have been by bold and able thinkers, who discern the abuse, denounce it, and point out how it can be remedied. At length, if circumstances are favourable, the pressure becomes so strong that the government is obliged to give way, and the reform being accomplished, the people are expected to admire the wisdom of their rulers by whom all this has been done." That statement is worth repeating. No great political improvement, no great reform, either legislative or executive, has ever been originated in any country by its rulers. Such things are not only not originated by government, but they are not originated by any party, nor by any abstraction. And remember that all associations are ultimately abstractions. Such things are accomplished by individuals, by citizens, by us. Unless individuals like you do it, it will not be done. That is the lesson of history. Where individuals will not make the effort, then there is no prospect of any external entity contributing anything to creative, productive change. While in all Western societies the vote has been won or retained, the value of it, unfortunately, has one way or another been depreciated somewhat. People who lived under the rulership of the Soviet Politburo also had the political vote. This was freely offered. Soviet citizens were expected to use it, and they did so. Of course, its effectiveness could only be judged in terms of the choice they were offered. In the days of the tyrant Stalin, 98.5% of votes cast were in favour of Stalin's nominees. This high rate of endorsement had something to do with the fact that there were no other candidates offering, and that the sanction of police powers was highly likely to be exercised against anyone who did not comply in sanctioning Stalin's continuing tyranny. The extent to which real choice at elections is limited is the degree to which democracy has been betrayed, neglected, or undone. Increasingly, issues such as immigration, the centralization of media control, and finance are subject to what is called a bipartisan approach. In these situations, there may be limited cosmetic and superficial differences in the phraseology with which one party presents the policy as opposed to the other. Nevertheless, at base, the parties are often almost identical, and therefore no prospect of choice is available. The idea that this freedom of choice can easily be remedied by the freedom to stand candidates is not necessarily quite what it would seem. In most elections, there are only perceived to be one, two, or three possible victors. In this case, the population is preoccupied with choosing the lesser of these two or three evils. Where lobbies with powerful sanctions, perhaps of a financial nature, befuddle political representatives and parties into a unit which is opposed to the popular will, true democracy fails and real choice is dangerously limited. The momentum of human habit bonds people through their upbringing and established prejudices to vote for one particular party or another. These habits cannot be changed in a limited period of time. Once the point is reached where a discernible and desirable objective is acknowledged, and the will is found on the part of even a small number of people to achieve it, then the immediate reaction of at least some of the group is to start to form monolithic plans to achieve the objective. Such structures tend only to add to the list of ineffective parties which are absorbed by the need to survive rather than achieve their original objectives. This is completely disastrous and is the rock upon which so many essential reforms have foundered again and again. Goals are indispensable, but they are not to be confused with plans and programs which are simply techniques. In discussing the strategy of effective political action, there are two rules that need to be considered. One is that unity is strength and that diversity is weakness. But we should observe that the opposite is also true. Unity is weakness and diversity is strength. Both of these rules have a validity and a truth. All that determines which one applies at the time is the circumstances. This dichotomy has long been understood in military theory, and we use a military model to explain it. If unity is strength, in a situation where clearly one's resources are lesser than the enemy's, then by pursuing this concept of strength, you will assemble all your resources at one point. This will greatly facilitate the enemy, and he will be much obliged to you, because his superior forces can then be assembled, and he will easily defeat you. For the adversary who has the greater resources, unity is strength. For the adversary who has the least resources, diversity, or to use military terms again, guerrilla warfare, is his strength. By widely diversifying one's small forces, it is impossible for even considerably larger opposing forces to be brought to bear on so large a range of small objectives. Therefore, in local situations, diversity makes it possible to gain a temporary advantage. Once the enemy responds and marshals his resources, there is no point in trying to respond by unifying your limited forces and making every effort to defend that limited objective to the last man. Forces should be dispersed and diversity maintained. The maxim that unity is strength is true for the status quo. Realistic subscribers to a minority view should not be drawn by status quo propaganda, but should seek a local situation which will allow the greatest leverage for their limited resources. Of course, there are always a small number of individuals who will never understand this, and who generally berate others with such slogans as, let's have a new party, or let's all get together and give a show of strength, and let's have a big rally, and so on. But the unifying of all interested people into a single structure tends to isolate them from being able to share their ideas with others. The type of movement that is required is united in that it shares a common freedom philosophy and it knows what freedom is. It is also united by common objectives, these objectives being to expand the effective prerogatives and sanctions of individuals and the right to choose or reject proposals which affect their own interests. Good ends cannot be achieved by evil means. This precludes us from forming a party and seizing power to impose freedom. Diversity of effort for those who genuinely seek a change in policy is a permanent strength because once a change is achieved and becomes part of the status quo to be defended, then they no longer need to be involved in seeking change. The idea whose time has come or is coming is always promulgated through diversity. The freedom philosophy is well suited and adapted to this type of approach, for it allows all individuals to place their efforts where they see their talents being best used. Individuals judge these things better than distant monolithic institutions ever could. This does not mean that the increment of association does not pay high dividends. It does. But the all-important personal initiative is best exercised by individuals who are not overly regimented and reliant for self-discipline upon their fellows. The organization of a free society is, after all, organic. Every individual living thing is composed of very large numbers of living cells. Each of these cells carries all of the information necessary to fulfill every function of the plant or animal. Small tissues of leaf are now quite readily and commercially grown into seedlings and whole forests of trees. In the higher life forms, communication cells form the nervous system, bone cells provide a structure to support the total organism, muscle cells allow mobility, while others perform the cleansing function of the kidneys, and so on. Freedom respects diversity in society. A free society operates in an organic, self-regulatory manner, as do living beings. One person is attracted to a profession or function which repels another. Some take a great interest in one area of life, which the majority find uninteresting, yet they appreciate the need for this function. St. Paul spoke of the organic nature of the church when he said, "For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ." Those who are overly ambitious or seekers of power usurp role for which they are not suited. In this way, they sicken the whole of the body and destroy their own highest self-interest. A free society takes on a highly self-regulatory nature where self-discipline is the primary disciplinary force. It has always seemed to me remarkable that the balance between the correct number of veterinary surgeons as opposed to the correct number of dentists, theoreticians, printers, butchers, bakers and candlestick makers so closely approximates the optimum relative numbers in the various professions. It's interesting to ask people why they chose a particular profession. Sometimes they say it is because the conditions were good, the profession seemed to have a secure future, that earnings were potentially high, or that traditional family occupations influenced their decision. One wonders whether behind all this there is not some greater self-regulatory instinct which reveals an appreciation of the relative opportunities to serve in the various capacities. A society in which every male had a compulsive and consuming interest in architecture could not conceive of service in any other way. A society which produced 50% of its population who wanted to drive railway engines would be a very unhappy, hopelessly disorganized, and disproportionate society. Service offers genuine meaning and worth to the individual and is therefore his most valuable prerogative. The realization of freedom potentials will require a freedom leadership and movement ordained to serve. We need more leadership among us, not more leadership over us. One sometimes detects derision of what is called one-issue politics. We agree that fanatical zealots usually thrash just one issue to the point that we get heartily sick of it. However, it is the power-motivated politician who has the greatest reservations about one-issue politics. Since the very essence of freedom is to be able to choose or refuse one thing at a time, anything which enables this to take place reduces the effective power of politicians. Inhibiting the centralization of power leaves the field vacant for those vast numbers who, through service motives, would like to ensure that the options for decision-making are presented in an orderly and cogent fashion. Political elections have tended to be reduced to the choices similar to those a child has when he wants to buy mixed lollies. Think about it. It is a serious question. Which would you choose? It obviously would be less problematical and would considerably expand your freedom if you could thoughtfully choose or refuse each of these things one at a time. An objection which is occasionally put forward is that government ought to have some measure of power which the people, at least immediately, could not veto. Otherwise, they would never make any of the hard decisions. This is nonsense. Yes, governments do have to impose taxation. But is there anybody who, when he goes into a shop and wants to buy something, is unable to cope with the concept that it has a price? If one wants the product and can afford it, one pays for it and is happy to do so. On the other hand, if taxation is beyond one's ability to pay, or in terms of value for money, it is not a good investment, then one would not want to countenance such a level of taxation. A community which wants decent public roads will not vote for nil taxation. If for 1 year they did, then they would most definitely be disciplined by the rising chaos of the roads to reverse that decision, and thereby would have learned something of considerable value. Organic society tends to balance itself. Reality is the great disciplinarian. If one walks into a door, it hurts. If one makes a public fool of oneself, other people laugh. There is no decision that an individual can make from which he can ultimately escape the consequences. Individuals who commit crimes sometimes escape punishment. Nevertheless, they can never commit those crimes without the knowledge in themselves that they are criminals. The knowledge that you are a criminal has simply got to have an impact upon your own sense of self-worth. A child suffers externally imposed restraint from playing with sharp knives because in reality the potential price is unknown to the child. Hopefully a responsible parent will have the child learn something of this with a blunt knife. Once adulthood is reached, external restraint can only be justified on one pretext, and that is to protect society. A man who can be proved beyond reasonable doubt to have repeatedly committed numerous sexually motivated murders is not incarcerated for his own reform, nor to punish him. This man is locked in a cell to protect society. The basic object of protection of society is as well achieved through execution as by incarceration. Other objectives, such as reform, are decidedly secondary and will depend upon perceptions of the cost, the risk, prospects of reform, attitudes, and so on. The concept that suffering is good for people is a spiritual disease and is rarely promoted by people who are experiencing it themselves. Suffering is perceived as something which is particularly good and uplifting for others. The discipline imposed by nature and God is sufficient, and there is no need for silly people to try to add unduly to it by seeking suffering as some kind of maturing balm. freedom enterprises require a great degree of personal initiative. Personal initiative is the one thing which no power mechanism has ever been able to overcome. The primary reason for this is that it is impossible to prevent individuals from doing something until you know what it is they are going to do. In a great many cases, an individual himself is not all that sure of a precise action until local circumstances suddenly present opportunities and inspire him with possibilities. A society which has been permeated with an understanding of and commitment to achieving perceived freedom potentials will find mechanisms through which to achieve them. Personal initiative will find ways to suit the circumstances. Individual initiative must be preceded by a program of public education and in the encouragement of those who are aware of the need for the advancement of freedom. Membership in political parties is not important in this matter. What is important is that each individual in his own situation takes personal initiative whenever a genuine opportunity presents itself to promote freedom potentials. This does not mean that every time there is an opportunity to open one's mouth that the hobby horse is immediately mounted and ridden into the fray. On the contrary, an opportunity exists only when another individual genuinely finds freedom potentials useful and relevant and has time for these reflections. For these opportunities, you must wait, and not on the edge of your chair. Knowing how to wait is part of learning how to respect the freedom of others. And if you can never learn that, then you can never properly handle your own freedom with responsibility and dignity. However, wherever an individual has achieved a measure of respect from his peers, his views will be sought and valued in an atmosphere that contains a willingness to listen. How often has one of your friends commented to you, "I don't know, the politicians just don't seem able to listen"? Here is an opportunity to introduce a small pamphlet on citizens-initiated referenda. Patience is essential. The best approach is not to try to create concern where it doesn't exist, nor to create interest where there is none, but rather to wait until you can discern an interest in a subject and then contribute to that and help that person to gain more understanding. Certainly, there is a place for rushing into the street and crying, "Eureka, I found it! Genuine democracy is possible." But it should always be done in such a way that the audience is not captive and they can walk past without responding. You must try to respect this. In that way, you do not build a wall of resistance against your worthwhile ideas. The three aspects for success, knowledge, will, and sanctions, have been mentioned. We have said enough about knowledge for the moment. So let's turn our attention to the will. Faith is of the utmost importance when it comes to strength of will. Faith rules every human action. Consider the most degenerate alcoholic passing a dollar across the bar. What occasions that action? Well, no matter what occasions it, it is passed across the bar in the faith that a beer will materialize from the opposite side. In the absence of faith, man is inert. Results either diminish or expand our faith. The faith that consuming lemons can cure scurvy grew because of the results of the voyages experienced, not because of the support of the medical profession of the day. The will to achieve freedom potentials will likewise grow or diminish to the extent that it can be shown that increasing freedom is a result which is achievable and which works. For this reason, victories of the citizenry, such as the successful opposition of suspect human rights legislation, or identity cards which would have meant a loss of freedom, have an importance beyond the issues. They show that those with the freedom philosophy do have the effective resources. Victories such as these, and even smaller ones, such as defeating a local council decision, are immeasurably important. Upon these victories, social faith, or credence, or social credit, is grown, in which people increasingly believe that the results that they want are attainable. Through small victories, one's faith that greater things can be done is encouraged and fortified. To the extent that you have been able to help a community achieve small victories, you have helped to grow social credence and the faith upon which the community's will can draw. Finally, even with the will and the knowledge, it still remains true that it requires sanctions in order to achieve an objective. However, one should never self-indulgently lament the fact that one does not have adequate sanctions. In any group intent upon an objective, there almost always seems to be at least one person who is more than happy to convey hopelessness. Oh, we could never do that. Or they would never let us do that. It takes many other forms. This amounts to a moral crime. If ever you are convinced that the achievement of a desirable objective is impossible, then you should stay home. Do not attend gatherings of people who are determined to achieve that objective. When dealing with a negative person, the following points are useful. A. If he believes the achievement of the objective is impossible, then perhaps he can explain why he is attending a meeting which has been called for the purpose of achieving it. B. If he does believe that its attainment is possible, why is he saying otherwise? In either case, that individual is placed in considerable difficulty. He is also helped to decide his future role, if any. Of course, I'm not arguing for a mindless optimism. Realism is needed and is tremendously useful. It generally transpires that individuals who most readily insist upon the impossibility of an objective, whilst at the same time being interested in its achievement, are simply trying to provoke others to reassure them that their objective is achievable. As such, they are attempting to increase their own faith by depreciating that of others. This is an immoral posture. It is very often exercised as a form of blackmail to force those who are trying to build social credence and to get on with the job to divert their resources and the group's resources to bolstering the negative, defeatist individual. Don't cannibalize the faith of others to support your own. Learn to use and value your encouragement skills. The truth is that every individual, no matter how poor or limited in many respects, has enormous personal sanctions. Everyone can determine whether he will be more cheerful or courageous in any circumstance. Every adult individual in the Western world has a vote, a limited sanction, but one which can and must be used in conscience to vote for something which is positively supported and for something for which the individual is prepared to take responsibility. Every individual can stop voting for the lesser of several evils. Every individual finds himself at times in a situation where a word of advice or a word of kindness can make a real difference. Every individual, no matter how humble or talented, has an opportunity to grow in the trust of his peers, thus increasing his own social credence as a person which will enable him to advance the freedom philosophy to the extent that he holds it. Trust is only increased through honoring the trust others place in you. Every individual can write a letter, can ask a question, can pass on a pamphlet. Every individual has the right to present their case and to support a cause. For instance, a person can say, "Well, I like the concept of CIR, and I think it may help in solving some of this country's problems." We need each other's input. When a statement is made, it should be considered as another option. Anyone who takes the dog for a walk can occasionally photocopy and distribute helpful material. In short, anybody can become a multiplier. The multiplication table in use will depend on talent, on the environment in which we are born, and on many, many factors. But any person can become a multiplier. So never lament the fact that your sanctions are inadequate. Simply use those that you have while you build more. Until you employ those you have now, there is no case for seeking more. There is a point of view which says that a person's class in society is determined by the time span of his consuming objectives. If immediate gratification is his consuming preoccupation, then we don't talk about such people. If nothing beyond a year or so interests him, he's a go-getter. He's lower class, no matter what wealth he has in his background. If objectives range to such things as owning a home and educating a family in 10 or 20 years' time, that's middle class. If you can work consciously with commitment and without needing praise to achieve societal objectives beyond your lifetime, you're upper class. To the degree that this is true, St. Francis of Assisi was an aristocrat, the Marquis de Sade a proletarian. Associated with long-term objectives is the progressive assembling of sanctions equal to the task. It is imperative that we make time for considering long-term objectives. It would be nice to have the sanctions that are associated with the media, such as newsletters and national newspapers. It would be nice to have the benefits of a mini-university, a quiet teaching facility somewhere in the mountains, perhaps, where families and young people might live cheaply during holidays. Access to resource materials in the form of videos, literature, and audio tapes would help enormously. Access to persons who have spent their lives in pursuit of these objectives might bring undreamed-of results. Effective educational infrastructures will have to be assembled for the victory of freedom potentials. In a free and responsible community, sanctions are personal. They are yours and those of your fellow citizens. Only you can use them. The use of these personal sanctions will lead to the effective use of sanctions, which are common to the community. Once this point is achieved, you will know you are well on the way to genuine democracy, where political and bureaucratic representatives are truly accountable.